Welcome to the Ed Visits Buzz. This podcast engages with teachers, educational visits coordinators, service providers, and parents to explore the joys and complexities of organising educational visits.
My name is Andy Smith. I am the Educational Visits Advisory Services Manager at Evolve Advice. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by Sarah Knight from the Allergy team. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your family and the Allergy team, please?
Yeah, so I'm Sarah Knight. I run the Allergy team with my two co-founders, Jen and Catherine, and we support schools and families and businesses to manage allergies. This comes from a personal point of view. I have two children who both have serious allergies. My eldest, who is 11 and has just started secondary school, and my younger one, who is Freddie, and he's 8. They both have allergies, and it was living with this that triggered us to start up the Allergy team. I was frustrated by the kind of poor advice out there, the lack of advice, and I really wanted to give places practical tools to support people living with allergy. We help families directly, and then we also help schools.
The statistics tell us that around 5 to 8% of children in the UK will be living with a food allergy. So most classrooms will have 1 to 2 pupils within them. And indeed, 20% of serious allergic reactions to food happen to a child whilst they're at school. And I know when we were chatting earlier, you've got some really interesting additional statistics on that in terms of the school environment.
Yeah, so 20% of allergic reactions in school-aged children happen in school, which is more than any other setting outside of the home. And also, interestingly, 79% of those allergic reactions actually happen outside of the kind of catering environment, outside of the dining hall. So that might be in the classroom, in other aspects of school life, on school transport, on school trips. We don't quite know why that is. We wonder if it's because the kind of catering environment is pretty well trained, but also, and there's a sort of real vigilance about food at lunchtime, but then it's thinking about other ways that allergens can come into the environment. That's also not to be complacent, though, about catering either. You know, they still very much do happen there.
Yeah, and we're talking about educational visits today. So I suppose there's a complexity around educational visits in terms of going beyond the well-controlled school environment and out the community and all of the challenges that could pose. And sometimes we're traveling overseas. Sometimes we are traveling overseas in less well-developed countries. And language issues could be a problem. So there's a range of complexities there, whether we're doing educational visits within the UK or whether we're overseas, that we're going to go on to talk about today. Let's initially start about the sort of the law inclusion. What does the law say about this side of things? You know, there are three main legal frameworks that we could and should consider when we're talking about allergy. The first one being the Equality Act 2010, which can, depending on the severity, define a food allergy as a protected characteristic of disability if it's severe and or life-threatening. And that says that you must take reasonable adjustments, is what they're referred to. So you must make reasonable adjustments for including that young person on a educational visit. So one aspect. The Children and Families Act 2014 would define allergies as a medical condition. Again, that we must consider how we get to manage that medical condition. And then the Health and Safety at Work Act says that we need to make reasonably practicable steps to manage risk for those that are exposed to risks in connection with our operation, that undertaking. So for a school, that would be staff, it would be parent helpers, and it would be children or people that attend. The law is really clear that we need to consider how we're going to manage allergies and other disabilities, and we need to take those reasonable adjustments and take reasonably practicable measures to manage that risk. There's a legal aspect that we need to consider. Hand in hand with that is potentially a financial aspect. If we are on the wrong side of the law, we can expose ourselves to both criminal and civil proceedings, which are obviously reputationally damaging. And financially, they have implications for us. But more so than all of that is the moral aspect. You know, it's the right thing to do from an inclusion perspective to ensure that all children and young people get access to these sorts of amazing opportunities. And educational visits are one of those things that are memorable. They have real impact. They help bring context to our learning. They're amazing from a personal development perspective in terms of teamwork, taking responsibility, being resilient. We could go on for sort of the whole of this webinar around why educational visits are so good for children and young people. And those with allergies should have that same level of access as well, Sarah.
Yes, definitely. And we do hear, unfortunately, of circumstances where they don't. And we just know, you know, you've mentioned how valuable they are, and they're so valuable. And to say to a child with food allergies, oh, you can't do this because of your allergies, it's hard to think about how that can affect them going forward. What that means, they can't do certain things because of their allergies. What else is close to them at a time when you're trying to build that confidence, that sense of independence? School trips are so amazing for that. They're also amazing because they really help, because they're out of the school environment, because they're away from their parents. This is a moment where they feel much more independent, much more in control of themselves, and much more responsible. So it really helps build their confidence in managing their allergies outside of the normal environment, and then can give them confidence to do more. Yet they're still under this safety net umbrella of the school. And so it's just such a great opportunity.
I suppose it needs to be a team approach between the school and the family, because my perspective is on this, that you as a parent, you must have to become an expert really quickly at managing allergies, because you've now got this little person at whatever point they become diagnosed and you realize they have allergies that you then need to take care of in the wider world. So I guess you can really help schools, and it should ideally be a real two-way process of backwards and forwards communication to ensure that young person can be included. Can you give me your perspective for your children in school as to how well that works, what the pitfalls might be, and what works really well for you?
Talking very much from my personal experience, my son had his first sort of 5-day residential at the end of year six a few months ago. And I really remember when I went to look around the school right at the beginning, the head teacher said, oh, and in year six, they go away for this 5-day residential. And I just was horrified. The idea that, you know, when I had a 5-year-old, that this was ever going to happen. But, you know, you get there. And he was desperate to go, super excited. But I was struggling a bit on some of the communication, not so much with the school, but kind of understanding from the provider about what kind of meals they'd get. Anyway, so what worked really well is I went in, obviously I've got a background in supporting schools, so it was slightly different in the sense that I could go in and hold a kind of staff session with all of the staff that were going on. I refreshed adrenaline pen training, but crucially also spoke about reducing risk, because, you know, ideally you don't want to get to the point where someone's having an allergic reaction, you need to be treating it, you want to prevent it in the first place. So I talked to them about the spidey sense that I and many other allergy parents and indeed school staff now have about allergies. And it's that sort of hunch, it's that thing that if you feel something's not quite right, if that I don't know, someone brings out some chocolates, they weren't on the menu plan, have they definitely been vetted for allergies? It's when, you know, if you're delayed somewhere and it's like, okay, we're going to stop at a service station, we're going to pick up some extra snacks. It's those moments that, you know, lots of things are really well thought through, but it's thinking through as well when things go differently. And so we had a big chat about spidey sense, which actually then, after the school trip, one of the teachers came up to me afterwards, and not with my child's allergies, but with another child who had a sesame allergy. They did realize that they did have to get in between some donuts that were being handed out because they may have contained sesame, but it was their spidey sense that picked up. So it's that communication. It's feeling like the school staff really know your child, really understand your child, really know what to look out for, and then making sure that everyone's trained. And I know we're going to come on to staff competency later, but it's that communication. It really is that communication. I had huge confidence in the school taking my son, and it meant my week was great. And I could wave Will off with a big smile. I mean, you know, the other emotions of saying goodbye to your child for 5 days rather than being overshadowed by anxiety. And that was huge. And that was so much due to a really proactive, both by the school and by me and, you know, all the parties involved. And that's great.
You know, it's a really good example of the school taking those steps to make reasonable adjustments. usually are not hugely complex. What they do need is time to put in place. And this is something that quite frequently comes up in terms of where schools are struggling with inclusion, be it around allergies or other aspects. Often they find themselves running out of time to put those things in place. And as I said, those things are often not particularly complex, but they might take a bit of time to think about, to put in place, to agree on, to communicate. So starting this process early is really, really key. And it leads us really nicely into the risk assessment process. Ideally, we should identify these hazards, a food allergy being a hazard, and decide on the level of risk. And it's highly likely that if it's severe, because we're going away from a well-controlled environment, that the likelihood of an allergic reaction is going to go up quite significantly. So it's putting us into the zone of needing to do something about it. And if we can identify that risk really early and then take specific steps for that young person on this visit and record those, then we're in a really good place to manage that. It shouldn't be a barrier and it shouldn't be something that we're struggling with inclusion. As long as we start the process early and we take a careful approach to it, that involves those people that need to be involved in terms of parents and potentially medical practitioners and the key people in school as well that need to know and need to be aware of and need to have an input into it. So top tips around risk assessment from me would be consider the prevention as well as the response. What we often see, and I'll give you an example, that the information recorded in the risk assessment for how to deal with an allergy is quite sparse. So it will be something along the lines of make sure that this child has their EpiPen with them all the time. And it probably doesn't go much further than that. It might say something along the lines of make sure that we tell the provider or we've told the provider. But from a prevention point of view, there's plenty of other aspects that need to be considered as well as those things. So for example, considering, as Sarah said, those stops that you might have at service stations, communication with other parents to make sure that they're not sending those snitching stuff every combination. And what have they got? What are they containing? And other aspects such as really making sure your provider does understand the severity, common foods that this allergen could be within, and then checking that understanding when you arrive and checking on a meal-by-meal basis to ensure that there's not been a mistake and a change of staff or something that they missed. Those are a few examples. Sarah, do you have some other examples maybe in relation to your experience?
Not just my experience, but others as well, is things like making sure that when you're traveling on transport, lots of people talk about the risk of airborne nut allergies, for example. Now, studies suggest that the chances of an airborne nut allergy reaction is incredibly low. The particles don't tend, according to the studies, to travel by air. But what is the risk is, for example, if you sit in a seat where someone's been eating a bag of peanuts or a grated cheese sandwich or something. So just having a once over of transport seats, whether that's on a bus, a train or the plane, because if there's lots of food residue, likewise picnic benches if you're having a picnic outside. So it's just being mindful of those and sort of having that understanding that it's not just the food that is prepared and given to them. Then it's also making sure, how do you know that the right sandwich bag has gone to the right child? Is it labeled with their name? Does it have the allergens on? If that's eaten by someone else by accident, is there a backup plan? Just thinking, you know, obviously things happen, but if you have that really good awareness in the first place, then the chances are if you need to mitigate it, you'll do it safely because you're thinking of that in mind. And so it's having a brainstorm before when you're writing the risk assessment of where this can come up to. It's also often the simpler trips as well that kind of catch people out a bit more. Like, there was one trip where a group of primary school children were going to a local secondary school to a science experiment, and they were doing something where they were dropping eggs to demonstrate gravity. One of the kids had an egg allergy and that wasn't risk assessed. So it's not just the big complex trips. It's also sometimes just those simple things. I mean, that goes to the same way as risk assessing in a classroom activity as well as on a visit, but just thinking those things through.
We've talked about now some really, really key things. Thinking through your itinerary and sort of step by step, and then round tabling that as an staff team, including people maybe so familiar with it, so parent helpers as well, and ensuring that we kind of have walked ourselves through this hypothetically from both a prevention and a response perspective. And for that to take place, we're going to need a fair degree of staff competence. So, you know, experience, understanding, potentially relevant training. So again, if we jump to the obvious, that would be having a first aider that knows how to deal with anaphylaxis and administer an EpiPen or an AAI, as it's sort of formally referred to. But there's more to it than that, isn't it, Sarah? And I know that your team deliver lots of training on the awareness, the prevention sides of things with regards upping that level of staff competence.
Yeah, definitely. So we've just finished refreshing our training program for all school staff, and it's for all school staff, for everyone. And it really helps walk through that, thinking about how to be allergy aware. So you are thinking about it in every aspect, in that prevention and then response. Really sadly, earlier this year, a ballet dancer called Orla Baxendale died in New York. She was 25 and she ate a mislabeled cookie. And the reason I'm mentioning her is she carried her adrenaline pens, she checked the labels, she did everything right. And really sadly, the adrenaline pens weren't enough and she died. You really don't want to get to the point where a child on your watch is accidentally ingesting their allergen. Now, they might. It is not possible to prevent that completely. Having that sense of prevention by being allergy aware, by having developed that spidey sense, which from good training, but also sharing that responsibility among all staff. So that we've been contacted by school staff who've been taking trips and they've been the only member of staff with any allergy training on a large school trip and felt the burden of responsibility on them just completely overwhelming. So why it's really important that all staff on the trip, not just one person, are trained, because they can help each other. They can share that responsibility. Also, if something comes up, say something happens with another student, you're not sending the first aider off with them and then leaving the rest of the party vulnerable. So making sure there are enough staff.
There's a really important message there. If I go back to one of the statistics you were saying earlier about how many of those reactions occur in places other than the dining hall. And if we can increase that level of allergy awareness at a foundation level in our staff team, then we're more likely to catch those scenarios, because we'd expect that the catering team have got a fair degree of allergy training. But maybe not everybody else in school. There's a real cross benefit there for school life in general, not just for educational visits.
Totally. And also it really builds that confidence. I think we go into a lot of schools where also not only is some schools where the awareness isn't great, but on the flip side where there's a huge fear. And I think people can find that fear really paralyzing. So trying to kind of bolster that confidence across the whole staff body. I mean, I get the fear. I totally get it. I live with it a lot. But equally, I also know that that's when it's things out of my control. I'm less likely to be able to plan stuff. So it's trying to kind of ingrain that confidence, like any other aspect, like road safety or safeguarding, where you've got that whole school approach and it's really embedded into the culture of the school.
Yeah. And that fear is, you know, it's an important one to deal with, because that's the sort of thing that's in the pit of our stomach that might make us make a decision not to include a child because we feel like we can't manage it. Whereas in the vast majority of cases with most inclusion issues, they can be managed with enough time and with the right staff and the right levels of teamwork and cooperation with families and with children themselves as well.
On that exclusion point, the damage to the child on the kind of mental health side and stuff like that is not to be underestimated. Children with allergies often feel excluded. Every birthday party they've been to, they probably can't have the cake. They're probably used to having sandwiches when other people are having really nice restaurant lunches. Their exposure, when you approach every kind of social environment that's got food with a level of anxiety, it's a lot. The more that schools can do to kind of break down those barriers, say, yes, no problem, this is great. This is not a school trip, but we went to a restaurant and in the summer, and the chef came out and said, I love catering for people with allergies. It's like, wow, this is amazing. And just that sense of inclusion is so important as well to their sort of well-being.
That leads us, I suppose, nicely on to providers, where we begin to share our duty of care. We will still retain the pastoral duty of care, but we're often using a provider to help us deliver activities or provide food in the context of what we're talking about today. or to organize travel and subcontract out various aspects such as accommodation and guiding, potentially meals out in mountain restaurants if you're on a ski visit, et cetera, et cetera. So working with your providers, really, really important to make sure that they are up to speed with the things that you know from a pastoral perspective. You know, you will retain that responsibility pastorally, double checking that they've got it right because they are only human. And, you know, the server might be a different server to last night in your residential accommodation, or the chef might be different. Something might have gone wrong in the background and it's hypothetically spinning the blades to try and keep the show on the road for you and something gets missed. So don't feel uncomfortable double, triple checking when you arrive to check understanding and each day and when the meal arrives. Scenarios like that, Sarah, they need to be done delicately. And I wanted to ask you about, and lots of providers use allergy wristbands to identify the child. And I suppose that's having it in a different color so that they don't have to ask and talk about it in front of everybody else and you can just glance and know who they are delivering the food to. And what's your perspective on that side of things as a parent? It's an interesting one.
It is a really interesting one. And, you know, within our work, we go into not just educational visit providers, but school providers where a different dining hall might have a lanyard, they might have wristbands, they might have badges. They might have all sorts of ways to identify the children, a different coloured tray, different ways to identify the children with allergies. It's not ideal to have wristbands and stuff. Equally, though, you've got to make sure it's safe. And so if you do have procedures like this, which many, many schools do, and we always recommend there's two methods of identification in the dining hall to make sure it's safe, then it's working with the family and working with the child to make this more of a positive thing rather than a sense of difference. So, for example, if you're turning up on day one and shoving a wristband on a child and they don't know anything about it, that's possibly not the right way to go about it. But having a chat with them before, look, this is what we're going to do so that we make sure that you get a safe meal. The chances are the child might have a level of anxiety as well about their food that they're eating. So if they can see the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, then that can really help them feel confident. So it's all about the kind of messaging and trying to bring the child along with you on this. If they feel really uncomfortable about it, then trying to look at whether you need to find another solution. But I think it's not landing it as a sort of fait accompli on the child 5 minutes before lunch. Also remembering that wristbands can get covered up. They can be swapped. They can be dropped. So what is your second method to make sure that if something goes wrong with the wristband, that you're making sure that the right meal goes to the right child? So it's mixed. I don't love it, but I can totally see why it happens. And in some circumstances, it's really good, just how it is approached.
So we often use providers for overseas travel, and typically a tour operator. And I'm going to give you a hypothetical scenario here now to explore some of the challenges that we might have. So the hypothetical scenario is that we're going on a ski visit to France, and we're staying in a hotel and we're working with a provider that's reputable, and we've told them about the allergy. On some of the evenings, we're going to be out doing activities, so we might be going bowling or ice skating, whatever it might be. One of the evenings is a dinner in a local mountain restaurant where you get the chair lifted up at night and it's all floodlit and you have dinner in a mountain restaurant, and it's a really local cuisine. And I just wanted to explore some of the challenges there around and language barriers potentially and information not getting passed on from the provider to the subcontractors that they're using. So the mountain restaurant and the ice skating rink might have a restaurant in that you're eating in after your ice skating that evening, and how things can potentially get missed. For example, out there are translated local language cards, aren't there, in relation to certain allergies?
Yeah, I would say that a restaurant up a chairlift, and if that's the only way and without direct communication, would be high risk. I would definitely feel quite anxious about that. I'd feel anxious about that if I was going with a child, because if you did need medical help, it would be difficult to access that potentially as well. So I'd want to be really confident in the restaurant. So, for example, do you have a native speaker in your school that can have a really good conversation with them directly as well as through the overseas travel provider, so that there is no language kind of gaps? Allergy translation cards are brilliant, as are translation apps where you can hold an app over, you can hold your phone over the ingredients labels and it automatically translates it. But there's nothing quite like the sort of face-to-face or the direct conversation, and especially from a native speaker.
And you raise a really important point there, that if you're halfway up the mountain and it's nighttime, and potentially you're not going to have the regular sea patrol on duty. So thinking ahead to, you know, we talked about prevention earlier, the response side of things, if something does go wrong, how quickly can we get medical care? How will we access that? And what will the standard of it be like? And I guess that moves us nicely on to countries that don't have the same levels of medical care as we'd expect in the UK and other developed countries. From your experience and understanding in the more developing world, what's the level of awareness around allergies and care for allergic reactions, broadly speaking?
It's hugely mixed, but I wouldn't say that's just the developed countries as well. I would say that as within Europe as well. Like, there's just such a difference between different countries, different people. It's so down to the individual. For example, if they're really used to hordes of school children from the UK coming, the chances are they might have really developed understanding and they might be quite unique in there. Whereas other places, it's such a case-by-case basis. I personally have had terrible experiences in some countries, and I don't know if that's the country thing or our particular experience, but it's really worth thinking about and thinking about how to navigate. One of the advantages often is a lot more home cooking is done. It's cooked in the kitchen. There's a real understanding of what ingredients are used. Some of the allergens aren't used as much. You know, for example, if you've got an egg allergy, street food in Thailand is likely to be incredibly risky. And so it's thinking about the local cuisine, how prevalent the allergens that your cohort has and how much they're in it, and then looking at the individual understanding.
It's definitely worth everybody being aware of the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office foreign travel advice and the section in there in relation to medical care, which will, broadly speaking, tell you about the quality of medical care, how it's accessed, how you pay for it, whether it's accessible via an EHIC or a GHIC card, or whether that you're going to be having to pay there and then, or whether it's likely that your insurance company is going to be able to be involved at that point in time. If you've got a child with a severe allergy, that's worth exploring in terms of making sure that you've checked the state of local medical care and you've got a plan around that. And sometimes, depending on the severity, you need to be talking to that young person's medical practitioner as to exactly what is the level of risk here, and would they advise that they travel or don't travel, and have that sort of conversation if you're going to a country where you really feel that the medical care levels are substandard.
And back to your France trip as well, the idea of the sort of up the chairlift in the middle of the night with not much else is sending me slightly. Like, also, don't be frightened to kind of go, we're going to go up the chairlift and we're going to have a drink at the top, and then we're going to go and get a restaurant meal at the hotel, you know, and adapting things so everyone can have the same experience, but it's just a reasonable adjustment to accommodate the needs of the children.
You mentioned home cooking, which led me mentally down the path of exchange visit. So foreign exchange visits, where your child is going to live with a family overseas for a period of time. And just talk to me a little bit around that side of things. Do you have any experience of it yet? Or are your children not old enough potentially for that to have been on the agenda?
Not personally, but I have spoken to schools who've sent children on these exchange visits, and I've heard of good experience, really good experiences, and not such a good experience, one of which where the student turned up and very quickly, despite the fact there had been many calls between the school and the family from native speakers, from, you know, really sort of drilling down on that understanding of the allergen, thought it was, you know, the allergies, thought it was all set. And then when the student got there, they felt deeply uncomfortable about it. And actually the school had to, within 24 hours, find another solution. And they responded really well and they did it. And they, you know, the student felt really uncomfortable about it. So I think it's also making sure that you've got a plan if things aren't going well. And it's not just the physical safety, it's also the how they feel about it. For example, if they've got a nut allergy or fish allergy and that's being cooked a lot in the house, that's going to make them feel really uncomfortable. So it needs a lot of planning, those. But amazing experience to do. But yeah, a lot of planning. And making sure that the host family is trained as well. Like, how can you support them with training?
Super. Do you at the allergy team offer training that could be accessed by an overseas family?
Currently, all of our training is in English, which isn't particularly helpful. So the short answer is no. We do have this thing called Mama, which is me and my allergy, where families can upload a photograph of their child, say what their allergies are, and whether they carry an EpiPen or a Jext pen or no adrenaline pen, what their dose of antihistamine is. And it will, through tech, we want a government innovate award to do this. It will churn up a 7-minute video and go straight to your inbox so that then you can share that with other potential carers. So it's perfect for like educational visits. If you want to send it ahead to a provider or to like an activity leader who's taking the kids. And it's a really short training video, but it does do the sort of key points about prevention and then how to recognize and respond if there is an allergic reaction. So that's a really useful tool that people can access to help brief a provider. It's also really good for occasional sports coaches, for someone standing in at the last minute. I've certainly used it a lot with my children. In fact, I sent it earlier today to someone for an after-school club to help them.
That sounds really good. And I suppose that's something that you could send to the contact in the host school who could then watch it and then brief the parents on it to make sure that the parents are fully up to speed if they don't speak sufficient English to be able to watch it and follow it themselves.
Yeah.
I've got an additional question that I wanted to ask you, Sarah, which is how would you feel as a parent if school said to you that your child could only go on the residential if you went along as well? How would you feel, or what do you feel your child will miss out on if school asks you to do that?
So schools have asked me to do that. I'd feel quite disappointed. Back to that point that we made at the beginning of the session, these school trips are so vital for children, especially those with allergies, to start taking on responsibility of their allergies themselves, that it's really great for them to step away from their parent and to start trying to take some of that ownership. For example, carrying their adrenaline pens themselves, checking labels, trying to navigate allergen matrices in dining halls, that kind of thing, when you've got the staff around who are also double checking behind the child, but it feels less than their parent.
I suppose a really, really important point is to think about why are you running this educational visit, and are you going to be compromising that by those sorts of expectations on parents? And often we run a residential for reasons of group cohesion and taking responsibility, being more independent, being resilient, and having mum and dad there with you is going to pinch on that a little bit. And that's the sort of thing from an inclusion perspective that we really need to consider before we make those expectations on parents. Ideally, let's plan as a school to manage it ourselves with support of an Indian parent. Sometimes it also might mean encouraging parents that actually, it's okay, we've got this, we're going to work with you, we're going to take on board what you're saying. And we're going to get ourselves to the point where we can help you to be comfortable that we can take your child or young person away and you can rest easy. They can have a great time with their friends and get that sense of independence and build those skills that they're going to need when they're older or when they're having to manage this all on their own in the world. If the system in schools is for children to wear their lanyards, but they don't wear them, what would be the best thing for school to do in the sort of the incident of that?
Well, it depends on the age of the pupils, the size of the school, how the dining room is managed. But for example, we see things working really well where there's a member of staff who's checking which students. So for example, the class teacher who knows the students really well is there just checking that they've got the right meal at the same time. The catering team knows who the staff is and there are pictures behind the surgery of the student. That is often the most discreet way to do it. If it's a case that you really want them to be wearing their lanyards and that the system's not working if they're not wearing it. So talk to the kids, find out why they're not wearing it. Are they embarrassed about it? Do they feel like they stand out? Is it hard for them? Sometimes we hear of kids being given lanyards and then they have to go and give it back and then they miss out on going out to playtime. Is there a way to make it easier? If it's a point of difference that they're reluctant about, can you think about introducing other lanyards in the school? For example, do you have a sustainability committee where they've got a green lanyard and then the kids with allergies have yellow lanyards and then the kids who are vegetarian, you know, without making it too complex as well for the catering stop. And then other schools I've been to have somehow made the lanyard like the hero thing that the other kids now also want to wear. So like, is there something about the messaging of the lanyards? But I would be looking at the whole thing, and it might be that lanyards in this instance isn't the right way to go and there's a better way to do it.
Is there an app that you recommend for translating ingredients?
Just Google Translate or Microsoft Translate, where you use the camera to use it work well. Just try it out a little bit. Sometimes particularly stuff like tree nuts and nuts can be tricky to navigate, and it's not completely fail safe, but it's a really, really great start. It always helps me, and then I double check it by also looking out for the words in the local language.
Is there an antihistamine that you recommend we generally take on a trip, or ones we shouldn't?
So I'm obviously not a doctor, but the allergy clinicians we work with are very clear on this. They recommend the second generation antihistamines, which are things like cetirizine and loratadine, which don't have the drowsiness element that Pyrotin do if a child is over 2. For infants, it should be Pyrotin because that's been more tested on them. But for any older children, then cetirizine is a really good one.
Thanks very much. How far can an EpiPen take you, essentially? Is hospital access over an hour away not something that could be accommodated if the only options you would have would be EpiPens until you get to that medical facility over an hour away?
This is really hard. EpiPens work brilliantly and a child fully recovers. Just from one EpiPen, sometimes 2 EpiPens, a child fully recovers. Sometimes they need extra support, like either more adrenaline or other kind of intervention. If it's a really, really serious anaphylaxis, then it can be quite short that you really need intervention, but that's going to depend on the severity of the allergic reaction. And just because a child has reacted in one way in the past doesn't mean they're going to react in another way in the future. I've certainly traveled more than an hour away from a hospital. It doesn't make me feel great. I just take extra care. So I think this is something to really work through with the family, with their medical practitioner. For example, should you be taking other things on the trip to help with that? That would come down to a very individual case, and I would really look at that. Also, is there anything between you and the hospital, like some kind of a field hospital? You know, is there an ambulance service that will meet you? Because actually the ambulance service also has an awful lot of stuff often in the ambulance, even if you're abroad, depending on where you are. So that needs to be risk assessed on an individual basis.
Yeah, super. And I suppose also the in terms of help coming to you, where you are, what the roads are like, in terms of access to you, how remote it is. You know, that could be that you're up in the hills and mountains in Wales, or you could be somewhere in the middle of the desert, somewhere depending on what activity and expedition you're doing. Getting help to you. How reliable is the ambulance service in terms of waiting times? We can consider that from a UK perspective, but also in some less developed countries, they have a very sparsely delivered ambulance service, so it may just not cover the area you're in, and therefore it's a matter of getting in the car and traveling, and therefore that needs to be considered. There's a range of complexities, and I think the key takeaway from this is that specific risk assessment for the young person in question and the location you're going to in terms of travel times, the distance.
There's also other things to take into consideration. For example, we were talking to one school who was organizing a really rim trip, and it was a kind of canoeing, camping kind of trip. So they discussed, they had a child with particularly complex allergies, quite a long list, but they decided to just not have any of their allergens on the trip. And actually, even with a child with complex allergens, there's an awful lot of food they can have. And so for the whole group, they just decided to eliminate the allergens to make it as lower risk as possible. So there's other ways to look at it as well and to approach it. We also, in really remote areas, especially when it's pupil-led, like a DOV trip or a CCF trip, thinking about training the other students as well so that they can support their peer if they're in a remote area and they need to call for help.
That leads me really nicely to part of Julie's short story that she shared. And Julie's son has an allergy to shellfish since he was age 4. Once he started senior school, the school nurse trained the teachers how to use his EpiPen, but also his friends as well. And he always carries his EpiPen. He has a very severe allergy. So Julie's really reassured that his friends can help him in an emergency as well. And that becomes increasingly important as young people become more independent and are less dependent on us and are taking more responsibility themselves and are potentially out quite a lot with their friends doing various things. And, you know, knowing they've got that support around them is reassuring for Julie. And I guess as your children grow up, Sarah, that's going to be the same for you as well.
Yeah. And also tying other kids into other aspects of allergy awareness. So, for example, we heard of a CCF trip where they had nuts in the ration packs. So as part of the activity before they went, the students took the nuts out of the ration packs and replaced them with something else. And so not only being trained on the emergency response, but on the awareness in the first place. And lots of peers, the peers will be the kids' biggest supporters often, like helping them to make good choices, helping them to have, you know, being considerate on the plane and or on the travel and not eating their allergens near them, especially if it makes them feel uncomfortable, or helping them navigate the restaurant menu as well. So not, again, just the sort of emergency response, but trying to help their friends stay safe in the first place.
What if a young person would like to participate in Duke of Edinburgh Award Expedition, where the students are likely going to be left on their own for a large part of it with no direct adult supervision? So they'll be remotely supervised by the staff team. Should the school adjust their plan by ensuring an adult is nearer than originally planned?
Yeah, we hear of lots of students taking part in DOE really successfully. And it's just, as you said, planning it before, thinking about trying to eliminate some, perhaps the allergens, well, eliminating the allergens before they go. So making sure that everything's been double checked, training the students. Also thinking about if they don't have any mobile phone reception where they're going, how can they get communication out there? Do they need some other kind of form of communication to get help if needed? It can sound overwhelming and a lot, but actually when you break it down, it often isn't. It's like, oh, okay, like so many foods are safe for even people with the most lengthy, complex list of allergens. And no one has to miss out. Like you can go, oh, but you know, it's not fair if the other kids don't have milk. For a couple of days, everyone can have a really great few meals without missing a certain thing. So it's just taking a different approach.
My final question is, and it's a question from me about the minimum age that a peer can give their friend an auto and pen injection. Linked into that, how okay is it to suppose it's linked to the DOV analogy we've just talked about as well. How okay is it to expect a young person to take full responsibility for their allergy? Or where does that responsibility lie in relation to school?
Really depends on the individual, and it's so age appropriate. I know from our allergy clinicians that we work with that they have seen children as young as 6 administer their own adrenaline pen successfully. But it's a lot, and it's a lot if you're feeling really rubbish as well. People often say to me when I hand over my child to like an after-school club or something, oh, are they all right? Can they inject their adrenaline themselves? And it's like they're 8 and 11. And I think, well, technically, yes, they have been trained. They know how to do it. But if they're experiencing anaphylaxis, they may feel really rubbish. They may be very, very scared. Just because they're trained doesn't mean they can. And so to have adult support is, especially with the younger students, is really important. But when they start to be navigating life on their own, traveling to and from school on their own, going out with their friends, they do need to be able to do that. And it is straightforward and simple to do. But having their peers with them who also know, even if they do it, but they know they've got backup, can really help. So, I mean, it's so down to the individual age of the student. It's down to how the students feel about it, how the parents feel about it. And so it's very much a sort of lots of conversations there.
Yeah. And fundamentally, whilst it's so, so important that we prepare children and young people for managing their allergy themselves, and we support them to do that, we educate them to do that, fundamentally, the legal obligation is on the school to have plans to manage avoiding contact with those allergens. And then if it does happen, how we respond to it. And so, you know, it's about having that, supporting them, but also it's about understanding what our responsibilities are, having a good plan in place, and thinking things through in advance, all of those things that we've talked about.
You've been listening to the Ed Visits Buzz. If you enjoyed this episode, like, subscribe and follow to ensure you receive our latest episodes first.